Good morning, everyone. From our New York newsroom, we bring you another in our series of regular reports of the news of the world, at home and abroad. Our first report this morning comes to us from our overseas reporter, Grant Parr, in Cairo, Egypt.
Hello, New York. This is Grant Parr speaking from Cairo, Egypt. While Germany's Africa Corps and Britain's Eighth Army faced each other across the Ivermore in no man's land, the Royal Air Force yesterday gave the Germans something to think about besides the possibility of British reinforcements. That was a setup. A temporary Sitzkrieg on the ground, a war of rapid destruction waged from the air. One nervously watched signs of increased enemy strength, keeping their fingers crossed. Other men, with their hands on gun trips and bomb releases, took immediate toll of the enemy's resources. It wasn't the Eighth Army's fault that its war was in the static stage. The Army men, less than a week ago, launched a strong, telling attack against German positions, which proved too strong to be broken. There is danger in attack, and danger in sitting still. The men who give the orders face a difficult decision. Meanwhile, the troops wait and watch. Happier men with no such tactical worries, British and American flyers need not wait to strike their blows. They haven't waited either. Yesterday evening, United States Air Force heavy bombers caught a large enemy merchant ship off the coast near Derna. Bombs fell all about the vessel and two struck directly. The stricken boat stuck its nose in the air and sank. British airmen, flying long-range fighters, loosed their cannon on the special barges the Nazis used for coastal supply traffic. One pilot reported, "I dived into attack and saw a blinding flash as the shells struck. After an attack by another of our fighters, we left the barge sinking slowly. Altogether, one barge blew up, one sank, one caught fire, two more were riddled with shells and bullets. RAF fighter bombers raided three more units, which appeared to be Axis field headquarters. In four other operations, British planes attacked a group of tanks, trucks, and tents, caused a fire and one explosion among a cluster of Axis transports, knocked out at least 20 vehicles of a group of 200, destroyed three tents, blew up an ammunition dump, flew through heavy anti-aircraft fire to raid vehicles grouped in a ravine. Over Malta last month, British fighters shot down 140 Axis planes, a record number. The next high was 122 registered in May. I now return you to New York."
And next to London and the report of John McVain.
"This is London. Last night, a small number of German planes made a short, sharp attack on Norwich. RAF fighters raided targets in the Boulogne area during the night. It's the British tradition to spend August bank holiday weekend at a summer resort. The government told people to break their tradition and stay at home this August bank holiday. But yesterday, the British kept up the tradition and jammed London stations in a mad scramble for transportation. They lined up for trains and packed every one bound for the seaside. One mother with three children told a reporter at a London station yesterday that they had to sleep in the station all night after three unsuccessful tries to get a train. Many people had to spend hours standing up in train corridors. They arrived at the resort towns to find all rooms taken and restaurants running short of food. Lines were forming at 7 in the morning in front of grocery stores and butchers, and hundreds of people were queuing up in front of cafes a couple of hours before they opened for breakfast. The senseless scramble is an indication of the fact that the British custom of trying to persuade people to do something doesn't work. If all transport is really needed for vital war work, then the hundreds of thousands who went to the beaches are delaying the war effort and should have been under strict orders not to travel this weekend. Czech sources in London have just told the story of the death clock of old Dr. Sedlacek. Dr. Sedlacek was a recluse. His house in a Moravian town was a museum containing more than 500 historical clocks. One, he would explain, had been handled by Napoleon. Another was famous for this or that reason. In the center of his collection was a strange and deadly clock that had never struck 12. It had been made to blow up a palace, but it had never been used. Old Dr. Sedlacek had told its story to only a few of his closest friends. After the Nazis occupied the town, Gestapo men came to the museum to ask about Dr. Sedlacek's son, who had escaped from Czechoslovakia. They wanted to take the collection of clocks to Berlin. Dr. Sedlacek agreed and invited the Gestapo to come back late that night to inspect the collection. Before they arrived, the old man made some adjustments and wound up the death clock that had never struck 12. At midnight, neighbors heard a big explosion. The house went up in flames. Next morning, the bodies of old Dr. Sedlicek and six Gestapo men were found among the ruins. Nothing was saved of the collection, but firemen found the face of one grandfather clock. On it was the inscription, "The hour strikes once for all men." This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
And now we turn to David Anderson in Stockholm, Sweden.
Hello, New York. This is David Anderson speaking from Stockholm. In an interview in Berlin yesterday, Admiral Karl Dönitz, the head of the German U-boat force, admitted that the countermeasures taken by the United States against the U-boat menace demanded respect. He said that contrary to general public opinion in Germany, operations in American waters was no simple task. In this connection, he particularly emphasized two factors: the introduction of blimps in the battle against U-boats and the fighting spirit of the American sailors and airmen. Now, he says, the future results of this battle are largely dependent on the merits of the fighting spirit of the two sides. In this interview, Admiral Dönitz, theoretically at least, lifted the cover on a couple of burning questions. He said, for instance, that the Germans had established no floating depots for gasoline or ammunition supplies in mid-Atlantic, and that they had established no bases on neutral territory. He went on to claim that the German 500-ton U-boat, dubbed a coastal boat by the Allies, was capable of crossing the Atlantic to carry out attacks without refueling. This was made possible, he said, because of superior technical equipment and because all unnecessary conveniences have been eliminated. He went on to criticize the Allies for what he called their lack of new ideas. This convoy system, he said, suited the Germans perfectly, since their so-called flop tactics, the one of concentrating large forces of U-boats against convoys, had better play. Countering the Allied claim that German U-boats were poorly manned, Admiral Dönitz said that the crews were all made up of volunteers, chosen because of their qualifications. According to a report reaching Stockholm from New York last night, a Mr. Svante Wendberg of Stockholm was supposed to have been one of the eight men arrested when the Drottning Holm arrived from Lisbon in the beginning of July. But it so happens that there is only one person by that name listed here in Stockholm, and that man is still here. This is David Anderson returning you now to New York.
For news of overnight developments in the Far East, we take you now to our newsroom in San Francisco.
Now for news of the Southwest Pacific, we call in our reporter at United Nations headquarters in the Southwest Pacific. Go ahead, please. This is San Francisco calling the Southwest Pacific. Go ahead, please. At this moment, we seem to be unable to make contact with our reporter in the Southwest Pacific. And here are some late bulletins from the San Francisco newsroom. A new target has come under the bomb sights of General MacArthur's raiders. A Jap-held harbor on the Key Islands in the Banda Sea, north of Australia. Allied bombers have also blasted a Jap cruiser in the same area. Apparently, the same vessel announced as probably hit yesterday. Other objectives of Allied airmen have been Jap installations at Guadalcanal Island, in the Solomons, and in the Gona area of southeastern New Guinea. The assault on the Key Islands was the first of the war. One Allied plane failed to return from the attack. At Kukum on Guadalcanal Island, fires were started in Japanese stores. Japs in the Gona region of New Guinea have been subjected to day and night attacks. The Jap cruiser in the Banda Sea was both bombed and machine gunned, but results were not observed because foul weather cut down visibility. A single Jap flying boat has dashed over Port Moresby in a night raid, described as ineffectual, and a single Japanese plane has picked Horn Island near the Australian mainland for its objective. This attack, too, was without effect. That the United States has been effective in the warfare in the Pacific area is seen in an Associated Press tabulation of Japanese losses. According to this press service, the Japanese have lost 314 vessels in all categories since December the 7th. From Wellington, New Zealand, an earthquake shook the entire southern part of North Island in the New Zealand group at 11:35 o'clock Sunday morning. This corresponds with 6:35 p.m. Eastern Wartime Saturday in the United States. Considerable damage was caused, but no word of casualties has been received so far. That Japanese cruiser struck yesterday by heavy bombs dropped by American long-range bombers may possibly be the second warship of this class to be damaged from the air in the past 2 days. At first, it was thought that the cruiser contacted south of Ambon, the former Dutch naval base on the island fringing Australia, was the same vessel which American planes had bombed last Friday. Comparing notes, however, flyers were inclined to believe that the warship attacked yesterday was a different one from the one that was left limping back to its base last Friday. And that's all the report from San Francisco. Now it's back across the continent to the newsroom in Washington.
Washington this morning is talking about draft revision and ceiling prices, about taxes and farm income. But the real question on everyone's mind, even if not on their lips, is when will we know the verdict in the case of the 8 Nazi saboteurs? The next news in the historic trial will come from the White House, and it will be big news. President Roosevelt's special 7-man military commission completed its work late yesterday afternoon. At least all of the circumstances indicate that this is the case, and it's now up to the commander-in-chief to review the commission's findings. It is also the president who will appoint the place and time for carrying out the commission's verdict. This is provided by the Articles of War. There is no definite indication as to just when the verdict will be announced, but official Washington, which has been receiving thousands of letters about the trial, will not be surprised if the White House makes the announcement today. Meanwhile, there's a growing belief in the Capitol that there will be a general draft reclassification within the next 3 or 4 months. Many men with dependents will be placed in Class 1A if it can be shown that the dependents can live on a soldier's allotment pay. Married men, however, with one or more children who are living at home are not likely to be affected by the new reclassification, nor are single or married men who are considered essential to war industries. In the meantime, a private fight is being waged in the War Manpower Commission over the question of banning enlistments for the Army and Navy. A decision is expected within the next few weeks. The Army and Navy are holding out for the continued acceptance of volunteers, but other members of the WMC feel that badly needed skilled workers are being lost to industry through enlistment, and they contend that the selective service system can provide the armed services with ample manpower. Taxes and farm income received their share of the Capitol's attention today. Members of the Senate Finance Committee, which is conducting hearings on the $6.25 billion tax bill, feel that the drain on America's pocketbook is just about all it can be right now, and they're reluctant to add anything more to it. They predict that the Senate will not succeed in devising new ways of boosting the yield of the huge tax measure. Most members feel the unprecedented legislation will pass the Senate in substantially the same form as it was received from the House. And that form is a little more than $2.5 billion short of the Treasury Department's goal. At the same time, the Department of Agriculture estimates that American farmers will make more money this year than ever before. Officials say income from present and future sales, plus government subsidies, will surpass even the boom year of 1919. And the answer lies in rising prices and record production. In fact, an all-time record of close to $15 billion seems to be in sight for the farmer this year. That's 40% above his total income in 1941. Leon Henderson is again adjusting ceiling prices to fit current needs. The 2.5 cents a gallon increase in the price of gasoline on the eastern seaboard will be rescinded on Wednesday, and temporary ceilings have been placed over lamb to meet skyrocketing prices. So for the moment, that's all from Washington.
These have been reports from Grant Parr in Cairo, John McVain in London, David Anderson in Stockholm, our reporter in San Francisco, and our newsroom in Washington. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.